Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
Good morning. It is the Saturday Morning Update. I'm Rick Fowler. Jeff Wolf behind the console. Jane Houghton, our producer this morning. And we have updates for you on that shooting incident in the nation's capital yesterday afternoon. It gripped Washington for almost 6 hours or so yesterday. And it was somewhat reminiscent of the sniper shootings that, of course, gripped the Washington area decades ago. The police chief, Robert Conti, said that there were a number of weapons that were found in the apartment where the shooter was, and that it was a sniper-style shooting. Now, the chief held a press conference last night with Mayor Bowser, and this is the very latest that we have from Chief Conti, and this was last night around 10 o'clock.
Today, evil reared its ugly head in our community. People were unnecessarily shot in our community as a result of a senseless act of violence. So far, I can report to you that the victims, we have four victims, and those victims are being treated at area hospitals. Three of those four victims are being treated at area hospitals. The suspect that we believe is responsible for this is now deceased. We believe that the suspect took his own life as MPD members were entering or breaching the apartment where the suspect was located. I am unable to confirm the identity of the suspect at this time, pending official notification to the family. But I will say that we put out a person of interest earlier, and we are no longer looking for that person of interest. I will also tell you that one of the individuals who was shot, the male who was shot, is a retired member of the Metropolitan Police Department. There's one juvenile child that was shot, and then the other two are adult females that were shot.
That is Chief Conti from last night, and he was asked some questions. There were several press briefings yesterday, and he was asked some questions, and here's one of his responses.
It's a very tense situation. I mean, you don't know what you don't know in that situation. I mean, we all, recall, back in that time when we had the sniper, the D.C. sniper situation unfolding. Unfortunately, that situation unfolded over the course of several days. This incident was over and resolved in a matter of a few hours.
And one more comment from Chief Robert Conti of the Metropolitan Police Department last night.
Again, this has been a very fluid situation, as you all can imagine. To have an incident of this magnitude to occur right here in one of the busiest corridors of our city, things have been unfolding. Information has been coming in very rapidly, and we're just, again, sifting through everything to make sure that we have all of our T's crossed, all of our I's dotted, and we really get to the bottom of what the motive was behind this. I can't express enough. I just think that it speaks to the depravity of some of the individuals that we deal with out here, someone who would do something like this. I really don't really have a lot of words for it. But again, I'm glad that that person is no longer a threat to the citizens of the District of Columbia.
And the chief reported that six firearms and multiple rounds of ammo were recovered from the apartment where the shooter was found. Now, the incident occurred on Connecticut Avenue, the very busy stretch of Connecticut Avenue at Van Ness Street. That's right by the Van Ness Metro and the Van Ness UDC campus. And it was unfolding at about 3:30 yesterday afternoon. It was in the 2900 block of Van Ness Street Northwest, and that's just off Connecticut Avenue. It's only maybe 100 feet up from Connecticut Avenue, so very close to Connecticut Avenue. Shut down Connecticut Avenue for the entire rush hour well into the evening. And again, the chief of police reporting that the incident is over, the suspect is deceased, and the community is now safe once again. Now, as that was going on, there was another shooting in Brightwood. This happened later in the afternoon. Three people were shot there, and a little after that, a person in a wheelchair was shot on Blair Road in the Silver Spring area. Just another example of the crime wave that is going on here in the nation's capital as well as across the country. We're at 6:15. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We'll be joined this morning, of course, by Cheryl Atkinson. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer will join us. K.T. McFarland, Jim Trustee, our legal expert, will be with us. And John Kizzy, White House correspondent, as well as Jennifer Harper from the Washington Times. So a lot to cover in the week's news this morning. Right now, Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center.
On the outer loop of the Beltway in Tyson's Corner, there is construction. Three left lanes are closed between 123 and Leesburg Pike. On 95 southbound at Quantico, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked approaching 619. On 66 in Virginia, I have no reports of any crashes or construction, both eastbound and westbound. And on the Maryland side of the Beltway, you won't be tapping your brakes. The inner loop and outer loop lanes are clear of construction and crashes. You'll be at the posted speed limit. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Trending warmer this weekend. In fact, this weekend is looking warmer than next weekend. Next weekend, high temperatures could remain in the 60s. Today here, your temperatures in the 50s this morning. We should hit 70 degrees by noon. Mid-morning clouds turning partly sunny later. The high 75 degrees. Can't rule out a shower in the mountains later today. Sunday, 85, your high temperature. Will be partly sunny with an isolated thunderstorm 3 p.m. until 9 p.m. 7 News meteorologist Veronica Johnson in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
Currently in the nation's capital, 49 degrees at 6:16 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
We are trying to make sense of the news, and it's not easy with the Biden administration. Now, as an example, Friday was Earth Day, commemorations around the world. In a symbolic move to reduce our carbon footprint, the president chose to fly Air Force One from Washington, D.C. to Washington State. He went to Seattle so he could make his Earth Day speech. Thousands of gallons of jet fuel leaving a coast-to-coast carbon footprint. Not only Air Force One, but the support aircraft, all using fossil fuels in commemoration of Earth Day. Do we wonder why people are confused? Do we wonder why his poll numbers continue to drop? Associated Press poll out this week, 70% of Americans say the country's headed in the wrong direction. 49% of Democrats feel the country is headed in the wrong direction. How bad is it? It's so bad that this is what a CNN analyst, Harry Enten, had to say about the poll numbers this week.
What's key is the lowest are tied for the low for the pollster. Lowest tier, lowest tier. This is 1 point off the lowest, lowest tier. And when you have three or four pollsters showing the lowest numbers for the president of the United States, that is indicative of a president who's in a lot of trouble, at least to where he has standed historically. This is the lowest. This is the lowest for anyone who is elected to the presidency and didn't get up there through the vice presidency. This is a really, really, really bad number.
That's part of the problem there is the polling for the president now. Where do we begin with some of the confusion? Okay, we can talk about the rollback of Title 42. And, of course, the government has used that to basically turn illegal immigrants around and send them back to Mexico because of the CDC and the COVID-19 pandemic. Well, President Biden is hell-bent on rolling back Title 42. What would that mean in Texas? Let's ask a Democratic congressman. This is Henry Cuellar.
Title 42 is taken away. It provides an incentive to the criminal organization to say, hey, now we can promote this, we can market this, saying that the border is open, and they make a lot of money.
So not only do we have the fentanyl coming in lethal doses, opioid deaths are up around the country, a leading killer of those from 18 to 34 in the United States, but that doesn't seem to bother the Secretary of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas, or anybody else in the administration seem to be doing anything about it. And not only are the policies in the wrong direction, but it's really hard to understand where they are on things. Now, as an example, President Biden is asked about the rollback of Title 42 in a press briefing at the White House.
Are you considering delaying lifting Title 42?
No, what I'm considering is continuing to hear from my, first of all, there's going to be an appeal by the Justice Department. Because as a matter of principle, we want to be able to be in a position where if, in fact, it is strongly concluded by the scientists that we need Title 42, that we be able to do that. But there has been no decision on extending Title 42.
Okay, so it's a little bit confusing. And Jackie Heinrich is with Fox News, and she tries to help us clarify this.
Biden said afterward, I want to clarify that in comments at the conclusion of my remarks this morning, I was referring to the CDC's mask mandate, and there is no Department of Justice action on Title 42. But even that statement did not answer the original question, which was whether the administration is considering postponing lifting Title 42.
Okay. Are you confused? I think we're all confused. Part of the problem for the president on Title 42 is he's losing support day by day among his own Democrats. The number is now up to 58, combination of senators, representatives in the House, and even a Democratic governor are all either against or questioning his decision to roll back Title 42. So he's got trouble in his own party. We've seen that. Many of the congressmen and senators running for re-election really would prefer not to have him campaigning for them, and they're trying to make a little distance between themselves and the president. Another part of the president's problem is the leading from behind stigma that he got during the Obama administration seems to continue. A lot of criticism as to our slow response to Ukraine and aiding Ukraine. More heavy weaponry has gone in, but we're like, 61 days now into the Russian invasion of Ukraine? Here's how Senator Tom Cotton viewed it yesterday.
The only way Ukraine can have a favorable outcome to this war is if it puts enough battlefield pressure on Russia that it has the upper hand in such negotiations. We've heard from the Biden administration for many weeks now about its strategy to try to either end the war or to give Ukraine more leverage at negotiations. What we haven't heard is helping Ukraine win the war. In fact, it seems like win and victory have been purged from Joe Biden and the administration's vocabulary. So that's why I welcome the announcement of these new heavy weapons that have been that we've announced we're going to send to Ukraine. I am worried that, like Abraham Lincoln once said of one of his generals in the Civil War, that Joe Biden has a case of the slows, that what we are doing now we should have been doing a month ago, what we're doing a month ago we should have been doing 6 months ago.
Senator Tom Cotton, who has been holding the president's feet to the fire on Ukraine, phase two of the Ukraine invasion, Russia's calling it an operation, but it is an invasion. Russian commander laid out plans for phase two, and plans are to take territory in southern Ukraine that would create a land bridge with Crimea, but it also brings the border of Moldova into the picture, and Moldova has already expressed concerns about the next Russian moves. We'll get into further detail on that with Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer coming up later on this morning. It's 6:24. This is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. The Saturday Morning Update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us this morning. Not only are the wheels coming off at the White House, but they're also coming off in the VP's office. I'll tell you, right across the driveway in the old EOB where the vice president's office is. Tina Flournoy is the latest staffer to exit Kamala Harris's team. She is a longtime Democratic operative, the most senior official to leave the VP's staff so far. Her deputy chief is also set to leave the administration in May. She will be succeeded by Lorraine Bowles, another longtime Democratic operative. Make that staff member number 12 to exit from the vice president's team so far this year. What does that tell you? How about that CNN Plus? Remember all the hoopla that was generated, all the excitement generated at CNN? New streaming service? Well, it was a major investment by CNN. They poached big-name anchors and threw a splashy launch party, according to the New York Times. New York Times says it ends abruptly at the hands of a new corporate leadership team. They go on to say, at sunset on the last Monday of March, CNN stars gathered for a gala on the 101st floor of a Midtown Manhattan skyscraper. That was the last Monday of March. Well, the last day of April, they're going to shut it down, stunning the media and tech worlds. They said it will abruptly shut down CNN Plus on April 30th. Quote, while today's decision is incredibly difficult, it is the right one for the long-term success of CNN, according to the new incoming CNN president, Chris Licht. Another one bites the dust. We'll check the news next, then back with Jennifer Harper and Jim Trusty.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
In the news at 6:30, as we have reported, at least four persons were shot when a gunman unleashed that flurry of bullets yesterday afternoon in northwest Washington. The suspect found dead inside the apartment at the scene. That announced by Chief Conte last night at about 10 o'clock. Police say the man had set up a sniper type of an operation with a tripod and rifle in his apartment, began firing indiscriminately at people who were walking below. The shooting was recorded and posted online. The four victims are all expected to recover. Destructive U.S. Southwest fires have burned dozens of homes in northern Arizona and put numerous small villages in New Mexico in the path of danger as wind-fueled flames chewed up wide swaths of tinder, dry forest, and grassland. Also, plumes of smoke filling the sky. More than 1,600 firefighters battling six blazes in New Mexico and three in Arizona. It's 6:32. Al BD is in the WMAL Traffic Center this morning.
On the Maryland side of the Beltway, no delays in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. On the Virginia side of the Beltway, it's clear on the inner loop and on the outer loop. Now in Fairfax County on 66, I don't have any reports of any crashes or construction eastbound or westbound. On 95 in Virginia, southbound, you're going to find an accident. Left lane is blocked approaching 619, the Quantico Triangle exit, exit 150. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Trending warmer this weekend. In fact, this weekend is looking warmer than next weekend. Next weekend, high temperatures could remain in the 60s. Today here, your temperatures in the 50s this morning. We should hit 70 degrees by noon. Mid-morning clouds turning partly sunny later. The high 75 degrees. Can't rule out a shower in the mountains later today. Sunday, 85, your high temperature. Will be partly sunny with an isolated thunderstorm 3 p.m. until 9 p.m. 7 News meteorologist Veronica Johnson in the Stormwatch 7 Weather Center.
49 degrees, 6:33, the Saturday morning update on WMAL. It is the Saturday morning update. Jennifer Harper joins us from the Washington Times. She writes, Inside the Beltway. Good morning.
Good morning, Rick.
You know, we've heard a lot about misinformation and a lot of mistrust now in the national news outlets after we saw what happened with Hunter Biden and the Russian hoax story, et cetera, et cetera. So you've got some results of yet another study, but this is an in-depth study. Tell us about this.
Yeah. Well, you know, usually when we talk about distrust of the media, we talk about liberal bias in the media or the just shoddy reporting and so forth and so on. And I do follow that a great deal, as do our friends over there at the Media Research Center and other spots. But this is something I have never seen before. This is kind of some interesting research here. And, you know, normally if you ask a conservative, why have you lost confidence in the news media? They're going to say, well, you know, again, liberal bias in the coverage and manipulative reporting, that kind of stuff. And this is something brand new. And here's what they say. Conservative mistrust of media is rooted in the feeling that journalists want to ostracize them. So we're seeing the mistrust of the media getting really personal here. And this is coming from a very bunch of academic sources, including the Coe Center for Digital Journalism at Columbia University, also the Nieman Journalism Lab, and that's associated with Harvard University, and also the nonprofit independent news organization called The Conversation. And this is what they have to say. This is coming from two professors of journalism at Ursinus College. And they did a lot of interviews, in-depth interviews, they say, with 25 self-identified conservatives. Here's what they found. Our interviewees view mainstream news outlets as part of a group of liberal institutions dedicating to making conservatives into pariahs. Taking this very personally now, the misinformation often at the heart of conservative responses to COVID-19 is a symptom rather than a cause of this distrust. Our interviewees expressed animosity towards the press, but they weren't primarily upset that the media gets the facts wrong or even that journalists push a liberal policy agenda. Their anger was about their deeper belief that American press blames, shames, and ostracizes conservatives. I think that's the first time I've heard this in a lot of years of covering this, but again, this is coming from kind of a triumvirate of academic sources, so it's something for us to watch, Rick.
While we're on poll numbers, President Biden continues to blame everybody else in the world for his administration's problems, but I don't think that's sticking now, is it?
Well, you know, let's concentrate on one very, very important state this year, and that would be New Hampshire. Of course, everybody knows that New Hampshire is, they've got the coveted title of being first in the nation when it comes to the presidential primaries and so forth. President Biden has essentially lost the admiration of New Hampshire. That's kind of a significant thing. And let's go to the approval ratings for President Biden up there in the Granite State. And they are, in a word, pretty lousy. And according to a St. Anselm College survey, 57% of New Hampshire registered voters now disapprove of the job that Mr. Biden is doing. 68% say that the nation itself is on the wrong track. And no wonder, because up in New Hampshire, just like everywhere else, the Bureau of Labor Statistics revealed that consumer prices in the state have risen by 7.3% in the last year. This is the largest leap in four decades for little old New Hampshire. And if the 2024 election were held today and the two candidates were Joe Biden and Republican governor up there, Chris Sununu, the governor would trounce Biden in New Hampshire 53% to 36%. That is coming from the New Hampshire Journal, a very interesting read up there. They conducted their own poll. They said on the question of whether Mr. Biden would be physically or mentally up to the job if America faced a crisis like a war or another pandemic, 54% said no, he would not. And according to Jim Merrill, he's a GOP strategist who knows much about New Hampshire, he says, New Hampshire voters are angry and frustrated, and these brutal numbers make clear that in November, they intend to hold President Biden fully accountable for everything. So he's not doing so well in the polls if you look at that important little state up there, New Hampshire.
While he's losing in New Hampshire, we can head all the way south to the southwest. What are the new numbers from the U.S. Customs and Border Patrol about his overwhelming success on the border?
I love the way you put that, Rick. And actually, our pals over at the Republican National Committee did all the work for us this week because they went through current U.S. Customs and Border Protection data. And here's what they say. In March, 221,303 illegal immigrants were apprehended attempting to cross the U.S.-Mexico border. This is a 27% increase over last March and a 331% increase from the average number of March apprehensions during the Trump administration. How about that? That's pretty telling. Anyway, among the arrivals, 14,167 unaccompanied children. That is still going on down there, plus 88,110 immigrants who were from countries outside the Northern Triangle. And the Republicans say that this shows that the Biden crisis is global. They also go on to say there were already more encounters at the southwest border in 14 months under Biden than in 4 years under President Trump. And kind of last but not least, nearly 2.5 million illegal immigrants have been caught attempting to cross the border since Mr. Biden took office. Additionally, more than 300,000 have reportedly disappeared into the United States in the last 6 months. And at least 600,000 gotaways, meaning people that simply got away, have crossed the border and escaped into the country under Biden. Again, this is coming from the Republican National Committee and their analysis of the numbers from Custom and Border Protection. So a lot to think about there.
Ups and downs in the cable news media. CNN Plus launched recently. Big hoopla. Well, they announced that it will no longer be with us after May. However, the Fox News ratings continue to get higher. So what's going on with the Fox News Channel?
Well, the Fox News Channel is always doing interesting things, and we have to remember that Fox News kind of set the pace here with Fox Nation. That is their streaming platform, but let's just talk about some of their normal ratings. They just continue to best all of the rivals in really no uncertain terms. Now, here's some numbers for you to think about. During the week of April 11th through 17th, Fox News marked its 40th straight week earning more primetime viewers than CNN and MSNBC combined. Okay, that's coming from Nielsen. And you heard that right. Fox had 2.3 million viewers during that time period, primetime viewers. That's according to Nielsen, compared to 1.2 million who went with MSNBC and 694,000 who chose CNN. And notably, Fox News aired 93 of the top 100 cable newscasts during last week. And they also topped non-news rivals like Turner, HGTV, History, and Discovery. So they're kind of ruling the whole cable universe right now. And if you wonder who's got the most viewers right now, that would be the Five, 3.6 million viewers. They got more than the ESPN NBA playoffs, and so did Tucker Carlson tonight. He had 3.4 million viewers. Hannity had 3 million viewers. And just one last bunch of numbers this early in the morning. In the Fox News morning program, Fox and Friends had 1.4 million compared to 466,000 who chose CNN's New Day and 786,000 who went with MSNBC's Morning Joe. And last but not least, this marks the 56th straight week that Fox and Friends has topped the cable news competition in the mornings across all categories, again, according to Nielsen. So that's how Fox is doing this week.
Jennifer Harper, Inside the Beltway at the Washington Times. You can follow her on Twitter at Harper Bulletin. Thank you very much. We'll talk with Jim Trusty next, get the very latest, some developments in the Hunter Biden investigation, and also the legal aspects of the mask mandates. That's all coming up here on the Saturday Morning Update. Right now, Al BD's in the WMAL Traffic Center.
In Tyson's Corner on the outer loop of the Beltway, there is construction. Three left lanes are closed between 123 and Leesburg Pike. On 95 in Virginia southbound, there is a crash. Left lane is blocked approaching 619, the Quantico Triangle exit. No reports of any issues on 66 in Fairfax County, eastbound and westbound. And on the Maryland side of the Beltway, you're not going to be tapping the brakes on the inner loop or on the outer loop in Prince George's County or in Montgomery County. And now from GarageDoorRepair.com, the WMAL Stormwatch 7 forecast.
Trending warmer this weekend. In fact, this weekend is looking warmer than next weekend. Next weekend, high temperatures could remain in the 60s. Today here, your temperatures in the 50s this morning. We should hit 70 degrees by noon. Mid-morning clouds turning partly sunny later. The high 75 degrees. Can't rule out a shower in the mountains later today. Sunday, 85, your high temperature will be partly sunny with an isolated thunderstorm 3 p.m. until 9 p.m. 7 News meteorologist Veronica Johnson in the Storm at 7 Weather Center.
49 degrees in the nation's capital, 645 on WMAL. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. I'm Rick Fowler. We are joined by Jim Trustee. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. See him often on Fox News Channel, like last night. And he is the former chief of the Organized Crime and Gang Section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning, and it's always great to have you with us.
Good morning, Rick. Thanks for having me.
A story that's confusing on multiple fronts this week that impacts virtually all of us, and that is the mask mandate ruling. Now, there's confusion because the White House has been back and forth on it, and the president makes a comment one day, and then they walk it back the next day. So we're all confused from that standpoint. But help us understand the legal aspects of this, because there's questions about the judge. She was a Trump appointee, and everybody's yelling and screaming about that. And walk us through the legal side of the mask mandates being lifted.
Sure. So it's really a very interesting read, at least for law nerds. It's a 59-page opinion from a judge in Tampa named Catherine Kimball Mizell. She got onto the bench not too long ago down in Tampa after the ABA rated her not qualified. So that's part of the screaming that's going on now, is people from one side of the aisle announcing that this is proof that somehow she wasn't qualified. But I've actually read the opinion. I think it's a very persuasive opinion when you get down to it. It doesn't have flowery language or constant footnotes citing where she gets all of her information. But for what was a fairly rapidly paced matter being presented to her for declaratory judgment, I think she handled it with a pretty good intellect. And there's really two things that are going on. Everyone looks at it and says, well, she's making a decision about whether masks work or don't work. And that's not really it at all. This is really a case about federalism, and it's a case about the powers of our government, how it's divided between federal and state, and then also a little bit of procedure, which I'll get into as well. But the main point is this. The federal government is not supposed to try to control the actions of individuals. Even if it's a big federal agency like CDC, they don't have the constitutional power to mandate behavior on a one-by-one level. What they can do in the context of disease is worry about things like what she refers to in the opinion as sanitation. They can issue orders about cleaning, about how to take care of property, how to deal with potential quarantines. But CDC authority is about inspection and cleaning. It's not about telling people what they have to do when it comes to wearing a mask. That falls into the category of state or local government. You know, under the police and welfare powers of the state governments, that's where you see case law over the years of them doing things like mandating vaccines, or in this case, perhaps mandating masks. So that's really what she's getting into. She does make passing mention of the fact that masks are basically little pieces of cloth that don't do much. She doesn't spend much time talking at all about the extremely sanitary nature of air travel, which I think she could have done to help support her finding. But again, she's not really judging masks. She's judging legal authority. And she came down with it saying the CDC has never been in a position historically where they've invoked so much power over individual conduct as we saw with the mask mandate. And then there's a second procedural problem that she sees under the Administrative Procedure Act. And that's just basically a law that says if you're a federal agency and you're going to publish regulations, you have to have a notice and comment process where the general public or people with a specific interest in the issue can kind of weigh in. And so here, back in February of 2021, the mask mandate got published without any sort of administrative procedure in advance for the public, and she said there's a real problem with that as well. So at the end of the day, 59 pages later, she basically says they didn't have the power, they didn't follow the procedure, and because I can't think of a way as a judge to limit this to kind of the geography of Central Florida when it comes to flying, I'm issuing this as a nationwide injunction. So lots of kind of hysterical reaction to this, lots of inconsistent reaction from the White House. But by the end of the week, the White House, through DOJ, had at least issued a notice of appeal, which means we might have a fight in the 11th Circuit over this very issue.
So the talk of an appeal, what do you make of it, and where does it go next?
Well, it's a good question, because the appeal being noted is a very small technical requirement. Sometimes it's referred to as a protective notice. In other words, sometimes the Department of Justice will note an appeal, but they're still sorting through whether they really want to push it. And occasionally, and this is a very optimistic take, occasionally they kind of read the tea leaves and think about the law and they say, you know what, we're not going to push this, and they withdraw the appeal before it ever gets to the briefing or argument stage. So there is some possibility that cooler heads will prevail in the White House and they'll actually withdraw this appeal. But the process of getting the appeal even noted is really disturbing, and this is what makes me kind of pessimistic. Normally what happens, Rick, is if there's an adverse ruling to the Department of Justice, the Solicitor General's office makes a decision as to whether or not to appeal it. And more often than not, they do not appeal. They look at the case law. They look at the ruling that came down, and they decide, you know, do we really on the merits want to push this issue? And a lot of times the close call goes to the judge. In other words, they don't appeal everything that comes out that's negative for DOJ. Here, all the public comments that were made by Biden or Biden spokespeople was that CDC is really important, and CDC might want to have a mask mandate, so we're going to appeal because they want us to. And that's really flipping the relationship on its head. Normally, DOJ is kind of in charge of this very legal-oriented determination. But here, for some reason, this White House, like with so many things, kind of gets it backwards. And they're saying CDC controls the litigation, which has really not ever been my experience when I was associated with the Department of Justice.
Jim, I'm going to flip a coin. Heads, it's Hunter Biden. Tails, it's Johnny Depp. It's heads. All right. So I guess we need to talk about the latest on Hunter Biden. Now, this is from CBS on Thursday. Prosecutors investigating Hunter Biden subpoenaed documents from a paternity lawsuit that included tax records for the president's son. And that's according to an attorney involved in the matter. Clint Lancaster told CBS News that. So what does all that mean?
Well, the first and most important thing is thank God it was heads. Because I have zero interest in talking about the squalor of the Johnny Depp and Amber Heard circus that's playing out on our TV set. So, again, I hope it was a two-headed coin, but whatever. We're good. In terms of Hunter, I mean, this is really an interesting kind of pivotal moment, and there's another lesson in here for Hunter Biden. You know, the first tragic mistake, the first self-inflicted injury for Hunter Biden when it comes to potential federal prosecution was leaving a laptop at a repair shop. I mean, that is an avoidable error that has probably put him in real harm's way. The second one was fighting a paternity suit with an Arkansas stripper. The bottom line is, you know, by going through the discovery process in this failure to pay child support case, he has had to turn over financial records, documents including his tax returns, expenditure statements, a lot of information, because ultimately that's going to factor into the child support. So what's happened from the prosecutor perspective, you know, normally federal prosecutors are not thrilled to have a civil case floating out there at the same time. It's usually, if anything, an interference with the criminal investigation. But in this instance, they're looking at it as free stuff. And they said, you know what, we're going to subpoena the attorneys, we're going to subpoena the court, we're going to get a whole bunch of information that we wouldn't have otherwise had because he chose to fight this paternity suit. And so they've got records coming in from 2014 through, you know, more recent days showing things like where his money came from and how he spent it, which could certainly be of interest to the Delaware prosecutors. So it's a big moment on that level. Again, there's a huge open question that we've talked about a little bit, and that is really where this Delaware prosecution is going to go. It's certainly been taking its sweet time. There's a lot of public speculation and maybe a lot of trickling of information from that laptop that are pretty damning. A lot of small facts and small transactions and comments that have made their way into the news over recent months. But the issue is going to be whether this is really a tax case or something else. And, Rick, I mean, I look at some of these things like Bobulinski and some of the money transactions from Russian oligarchs, and I think a real federal prosecutor will be looking at this, following the money like they did all the way in Arkansas, but looking at it for things like honest services fraud from the vice president's seat, aiding and abetting notions from his son, things like wire fraud, money laundering, Foreign Agency Registration Act, Foreign Corrupt Practices Act. There's a whole slew of important federal laws that are in play in this case. But the defense attorneys were the ones that said, well, it's just a little tax problem. And if it is a tax case, and if it's only a tax case, then I think we should expect to have an awful lot of cynicism about why it's that limited. But again, all roads lead to the Attorney General. So eventually, whatever the resolution of this case, whether it's an indictment, whether it's a Friday midnight plea, you know, whatever it's going to be, it's going to go through this particular Attorney General, and he's going to have the final say. And I think that's a really a historic integrity test that's looming for him to see whether he's going to treat this guy as the president's son or as anyone else would be treated that didn't have the last name of Biden.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. Follow him on Twitter at Trusty Lawyer. Thank you, Jim.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
You too. 6:55, it's the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We'll talk with John Gizzi next. And also coming up, we have got KT McFarland, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, and Cheryl Atkinson. Stay with us.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.